This is an ABC podcast.
It's a joy. It's an absolute joy.
It is phenomenal.
Those words, I could bathe in them.
There are pleasures and little intense moments that are really terrific about this book.
Good storytelling, characters you believe in and recognize, very human characters.
The most beautiful pages that I've ever read.
This book is a difference maker.
Hi, I'm Kate Evans, and this is The Bookshelf. A six-year-old boy takes a few extra steps away from his mum while she's hanging out the washing and is swallowed by a dust storm. An entire community rallies to find him, but every searcher has their own agenda, ways of looking at the landscape and each other. And that complex anxiety of the lost child, well, it might seem terribly familiar. But somehow Fiona McFarlane has managed to take that story and change it, change the angles on how we look at it. It's the 1880s and her novel is called The Sun Walks Down. Fiona McFarlane, thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on The Sun Walks Down. What an astonishing book.
Thank you so much.
Look, it's 1883, South Australia, on the outskirts of a small town. Why that place and that time?
Well, we'll start off with the place, which is the Flinders Ranges in South Australia. As soon as I visited that area, I fell in love with it. I knew I needed to write about it. I was fascinated by its history, by its beauty, by its extraordinary, singular geology. Everything about it was intriguing to me. And I was so intrigued in particular by all of the colonial ruins that I was seeing scattered throughout the landscape. And I learned that in the late 19th century, people moved into this arid area of South Australia and tried to grow wheat because they believed that rain would follow the plough. All they needed to do was plough the earth and then the rain would conveniently come. And it didn't work out, funnily enough. And they all left again within the space of 10 to 15 years. And I got really interested in the idea of a settlement that didn't work and the ways in which I might be able to explore some of the received ideas or mythologies about Australian settlement that we're used to encountering.
Well, one of those stories that comes up again and again in 19th century stories about Australia is the lost child. So what is it about the lost child narrative that interested you?
Well, to begin with, when I was in the Flinders the very first time, I encountered a story that was quite moving about a boy of five who went missing from an area near the town of Hawker. And I was thinking about whether or not I was allowed to write a novel about a little boy who goes missing, because we have such a storied and in some ways problematic cultural mythology around lost white children in a landscape that is often projected upon as hostile or sinister in some way. And I thought, well, if I'm going to have to write about the Flinders Ranges, because the place itself is sort of insisting, then what if I were to actually tackle that narrative and play around with it, especially because I'm writing something set in the 19th century. So the book is set around the same time that the two most famous missing children, sort of bush lost children, took place, the Cooper Duff children in 1864, and they survived. And then the Dalesford children in 1867 who didn't. And both of those accounts were so sentimentalized. Jane Cooper Duff was sent, you know, garlands from the UK. Queen Victoria was informed that they'd been found. She continued to be referred to as a bush heroine throughout her life. So we have a tradition of this terrible, genuine fear of children going missing. And then this additional kind of national myth-making going on around it that we see in our literature, we see it in our film, in art as well. And that's the narrative that I got really interested in sort of poking at a little and seeing if I could pull it apart, investigate it a little, while still acknowledging that having a child go missing is terrifying.
You really do pull apart that story, but let's go to how you do that in this novel of yours. So there's a small boy named Denny, he's 6 years old, around whom the action is centred. But what type of child is this boy?
Denny is quite a fanciful child. He has grown up in this place, this arid, remote region, and it's all he knows. One of the things I wanted the book to also pay attention to is the way that the Australian landscape means differently for different people. So it's not hostile and sinister for example, to a child who's grown up there or to an Aboriginal person for whom it's their country. And Denny has spent the 6 years he's been on Earth learning Bible stories, learning Greek myths, hearing his father's stories about bogeymen in the East Anglian Fens, and hearing his father's employee, Billy, who's an Aboriginal man, tell stories about country as well. And so Denny, sort of fanciful, but, you know, still a fairly sensible boy, has combined all of these things and come up with his own cosmology, his own sense of what haunts the landscape, what he needs to be afraid of. And that sense of imagination is really the thing that gets him in terrible trouble.
And it's a dust storm that sort of spins him around and makes the landscape unfamiliar to him, and that's why he gets lost. But we don't spend the book just with him. We meet all of the people, or so many of the people, who are touched by this loss. Now, he has a whole stack of sisters and an absent older brother, but tell us about one of those sisters, Sissy, because she is quite a character.
I'm glad you say so. Sissy was such enormous fun to write. She is, in some ways, my brilliant career, kind of cranky, ambitious teenager sort of character, but she's not artistic. She's not hoping for great things in life. She's just trying to figure out how it is that she should exist when she doesn't quite fit the pattern of what a sort of polite, sensible young woman should be. So she's a teenager in a certain sense, but not in quite the sense we imagine in the 20th and 21st century. So she's still very bound by the 19th century. But she's full of desires she doesn't understand. She's full of idealism that she's not particularly practical about yet. She's desperate to achieve something, to help with something, to have some great idea. And she's just kind of really bossy and cross all the time as
she
well.
She is gloriously furious. And she's also terribly competent, which is one of the other things that defines her. But at one point in the book, you write, "No one," says the Bible, "lights a lamp and puts it in a cellar." "Not true," thinks Sissy. "The world is a cellar and I am lit." So what is it that's lit her up?
I'm not sure that she knows yet. I mean, I think that's one of the things she's trying to figure out throughout the novel. It's certainly not religion. It could be love. I mean, I would love to keep following Sissy and find out more about what happens to her. We only see her when she's 15 and then briefly into the future. So I don't know exactly what it is, but she feels luminous and radiant in some way, and she doesn't want to waste that. And she's being told by people around her that she needs to sort of dim that light, and she's not prepared to.
You wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of her scorn as another character like this completely hopeless vicar is, because she'll sort of mutter her thoughts out loud at them, won't she?
Yes, she will.
Now, we meet a number of other women who negotiate the world in different ways. There's Sissy's mother, who's deaf, Minna, who's sort of all sensuality and delight, and Bess, so she's an English woman who has a room that she enters into. What is that room?
So Bess's room is a projection of her husband's, actually. I'm not sure that Bess is aware she has this room. But Bess and her husband, Carl, are European artists. Carl is Swedish, very good looking. His talent at art and his beauty come to him very easily. And so he's terribly afraid that he's deeply lazy and superficial, in fact, artistically and intellectually. Whereas Bess is much more serious. She's an English painter. She arranges everything about their lives. She makes sure they get paid. She makes sure they get fed. She checks the maps on their trips through the desert, all of those things. And the way that Carl conceives of this deep competence and ability to be practical in life is that she has a room that she's able to enter. And sometimes she allows you to come in along with her, and other times she doesn't. But it's more than just practical. I think he says it's more than just practical, that would be merely dull. There's also something very comforting and very strong about that room, as if it's a safe hold of some kind.
And yes, as you say, this is his version of her, this man, this Swedish painter. And through him, we see the colour and vibrance of this world, this landscape, especially its sky, through his eyes. So what does he see as he looks up and out at this place in South Australia?
Well, he sees an alien landscape that's at the same time strangely familiar to him. So he's astonished to find that there are pine trees. There are native Australian pine trees, and they remind him a little bit of Germany, for example. So there are ways in which he wants it to be more stereotypically sort of empty and dusty and severe, and then other ways in which he is comforted by the fact that it's springtime and the weather's quite nice and there's beauty around him. He's always trying hard to fit himself into the landscape and to think about it in his own terms, which is something that European artists tended to do quite naturally at that time. But he's also encountering these incredible sunsets for the first time. So the sunsets during the time of the novel are really extraordinary. They're sort of brighter and redder than anything he's ever seen before. And he's convinced that these extraordinary skies are really specific to this place that he is visiting. And he feels as if he has been sent there specifically to capture them in paint. And that might not turn out to be the case, but that is the way he feels about it. So it's sort of a burden and a gift and a responsibility. And it's all very much about Carl, probably more than it is about the landscape itself.
But through this book, we revisit this landscape again and again in different ways and through the eyes of different characters. So there's Billy. Billy knows the land in a different way. So tell us about him.
Well, to talk about Billy, I really need to talk about the sheep and cattle station that's just outside the town that I invented in the Flinders. I invented a place called Thalassa, which is based on an actual station that was run by the son of an earl who did die in a flooding creek in the mid-19th century. So I stole some of those things and I created this place called Thalassa, which was created by a kind of whimsical English aristocrat who befriends isn't even quite the right word. He adopts, in a way, a young Aboriginal boy who is really good at cricket, or who he notices is extremely coordinated. And he basically works to separate Billy from traditional ways of life because he is grooming him as a marvel, as a wonder. He's a big collector. So he loves finding strange things and surprising his guests with them. And I suppose Billy is one of those things for him. And this is all tracking alongside the fact that he is in the first generation of settlers in the region. So he was there for the kind of frontier wars, for the invasion, for the violence, etc. So while he's separating Billy from his traditional way of life and his people, he's also changing that way of life and the landscape that it's so connected to just completely. So this all happened before the novel starts. By the time we meet Billy, he's a middle-aged man. He is now working for the family who have the little boy who goes missing. He feels a deep loyalty to the little boy, a love for the boy, but he's also quite torn about how he fits into the landscape, into the various societies that he's part of. He stopped playing cricket because he's too good. The town and the station basically decided it was unfair to have someone as good as he was, but he's still obsessed with cricket. So he's very caught up in those questions.
He is a wonderful character, and I feel like as I'm talking to you, I'm avoiding the plot because there's a lot of plot, there's a lot going on, but there are so many characters and they're all fully realised. I feel like I get the background and the stories of all of them, even those who I meet really briefly. And, you know, so we see Billy's sister and his relatives, and even when they're not there on the page a whole lot, I feel like you've created whole lives for them. Is that how you work?
Yes, thank you for saying that. I mean, I love that. I wanted a feeling of sort of dense and complicated population. One of the books that I adore and that I reread while I was writing the book was Middlemarch. Just that sense of a whole community that has real texture and life and weight to it. So that is exactly what I was going for. And then in terms of the characters themselves, I mean, I do know them very well. I'm interested in their pasts just in terms of thinking about how they turned out the way they have, what it is about the way they were brought up and where that happened and the things that have happened to them might lead them to make the decisions that they do in the novel or to hold the opinions, good or bad, that they do in the novel. So I'm very interested in how people are made.
You're listening to the writer Fiona McFarlane speaking to me, Kate Evans, about her novel, The Sun Walks Down. But this 19th century landscape she has created is, of course, one also created by both ancient stories and more recent moments of contact. She has peopled the landscape with everyone who has to be there. So just how tricky was it, I wondered, to write her way into Aboriginal stories?
Yes, of course, it's difficult, and there are so many difficulties to it, and it is an anxiety, it is a concern, it is a problem in white writing about Australian history that I hope the book itself actually deals with, because when I think about writing, when I thought about writing a colonial novel, I was worried about whether or not I could do justice to Aboriginal characters, I could create something that wouldn't put something harmful out into the world. And, you know, I consulted with people, I did enormous amounts of research, I spent time on country, but I also built into the novel concerns about who gets to tell whose story. Billy is the only main point of view character who I actually bring to life in an intimate kind of way. And he's separated from his traditional Aboriginal life. So he felt to me like a sensibility or a consciousness that I could inhabit and explore, because he felt detached in some ways from and had a sense of what he'd lost without knowing exactly what it was that he'd lost. But I found it sort of anxious, anxiety making, etc. It's that difficulty that the great gift of fiction is embodied perception, that we get to write about ideas and thoughts and feelings and perceptions, but we have to give them bodies. And then there's that question, whose perception am I allowed to embody? Am I capable of embodying someone else's perception? Am I taking advantage? Am I appropriating? Am I doing a good enough job? Is it worth the risk of harming other people? And I hope the novel asks all of those questions without necessarily answering them. So it acknowledges those things, it throws them into the mix. Sometimes sort of specifically, there's one section where we have the letter to the editor of a very officious white man who claims to be speaking on behalf of Aboriginal people. We have instances where artists in the book are doing, I'm trying not to give things away, selfishly manipulating situations they find themselves in to their own ends. We have a sense, I hope, of a novel that isn't trying to tell us a picture-perfect, smooth, all-knowledgeable story about exactly how 19th century Australia was. I wanted it to be messier than that, and noisier than that, and to be asking questions about who gets to talk about this particular time in our history and how they should do it.
Yes, because this is what we see, is this quite vibrant, busy landscape that has Chinese and Afghan and German and Swedish characters and people who've had all sorts of lives and for various reasons are coming through this place. Why was that important to you?
I think partly because of the way we tend to think of, or when I say we, I'm really generalizing, but sort of Australian cultural mythology from settlement up until now to an extent tends to think of the interior as empty and as sort of wilderness and bare. And one of the things that I wanted to explore was all the ways in which it's extremely full and dense and rich, depending on who it is who's experiencing the place. And I wanted to think more about how multicultural our post-settlement history actually is. We tend to sort of think of it as being quite black and white, you know, literally. But the story of the Afghan Kamilis, who are really responsible for opening up the interior of Australia, was one that I was never told until I was an adult. So I wanted to take a look at 19th century Australia in all its messy, multilingual, multicultural glory and plunge into that cacophony a little with the novel.
And boy, have you done that. So how much then do you feel that this novel of yours, The Sun Walks Down, is in conversation with or perhaps pushing back against other versions, perhaps other fictional versions in particular, of 19th century Australia?
Yes, absolutely. I think it is, I hope, in deep conversation with certain received narratives of the 19th century that have bled into the 20th and 21st century about what settlement means, what frontiers look like, what our history, who populated our history, all the things that we choose to forget about invasion, all the things that we choose to forget about immigration, and in return sort of come up with a much easier, more palatable story. And the 19th century, as we know, was good at creating myths about the bush. I think of writers like Henry Lawson, I think of Marcus Clarke, but I also think of books like Picnic at Hanging Rock. I think of the children's classic Dot and the Kangaroo, which one of my characters sort of writes her own version of Dot and the Kangaroo. A child goes missing in the bush and is rescued by a bush animal. There are all these instances we have in fiction in which the bush is sinister, in which it's cruel, and it's harsh, and it's an empty wilderness, etc. And I think that is a tradition that Australian literature more recently is pushing back against. And my book is certainly very interested in that pushing back.
And the other set of books that might sit somewhere on the same bookshelf as this novel of yours are those sort of amateur anthropological studies that were quite a big thing in the late 19th and early 20th century. And one character in your book is busily writing and rewriting these in his head.
Yes, he is. And he is very deliberately the worst person probably in the novel, and also the Australian writer in the novel, which is another one of the ways that I hope the book is interested in, in these anxieties about, you know, who gets to tell history and what has the cost of that been up until now. And absolutely, I was reading a lot about gentlemen anthropologists in the Australian deserts in the 19th century and all of the ways in which they both preserved vital information, precious, rich information, while at the same time colluding in its destruction. It's fascinating, the history of writing and destruction in this country. And so I wanted to create a character who felt that he had the authority to write about it in an officious kind of way, and had a very set idea of the kind of story he thought it was necessary to tell.
And if you haven't read it yet, I think you'll be very interested in Paul Daly's novel, Jesus Town, which also has one of these characters who also mythologizes himself as a saviour figure in supposedly preserving and protecting Aboriginal culture while making himself the centre of the story. It's set a bit later than your one. But as well as, I'm wondering what other traditions or contexts you'd place this novel in. I mean, you've already mentioned Middlemarch, as well as Australian fiction that represents 19th century Australia. But in the imagining the biggest possible bookshelf that you'd place your own novel on, what other sort of influences or touchstone novels would you put next to The Sun Walks Down?
I would put, I mean, this is sort of connected to things that I mentioned before, books that I'm sort of writing against, but also, you know, in the awestruck shadow of, would include books like Patrick Wise's The Tree of Man and also Voss, you know, these books that tend to mythologize or mysticize the interior and our exploration of it or our conquering of it. Books that I love and find complicated and difficult and beautiful and problematic and all of those things all at once. So I would say that White and the way he writes our history and the way he writes the bush is absolutely present in everything that I'm doing in this book. In terms of touchstone novels, really, I think the only other one that springs to mind is a novel by the Japanese writer Junichiro Tanizaki called The Makioka Sisters. This is a Japanese novel of the 1940s, one of my favorite novels. It's another novel with a lot of sisters in it. And I was already writing my novel with a lot of sisters in it when I encountered this book for the first time. I read it during a heat wave in Sydney when it was far too hot to do anything but lie on my bed reading. I read it in 3 days. It's long and dense, and it has that sense of a dense population along with very singular, definite, clear-cut characters who all interact with each other in complicated ways. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, this is going to help me.
Oh, what a fantastic example. You're living and teaching in the US. Do you ask your students to read Australian fiction? Is that part of the conversation you have with them or not?
I do. Every semester when I start teaching a creative writing class at Berkeley, I ask my students if they've read any Australian literature, and it's extremely rare that any of them have, which breaks my heart. And so I make them read Australian literature in every class I teach. So just tomorrow I'm going to be teaching a story from Ceridwen Dovey's Only the Animals. I teach Namlee as well, from stories from Namlee's The Boat. I would love to teach a class on Australian literature just in general, but when I think about how I would organize that, I get sort of intimidated. But I'm always pushing people in the direction of Australian writers. You know, my students who are particularly interested in something, I'll nudge them toward Michelle de Kretzer and say, you've got to read this. It's one of the great pleasures of what I do, is introducing people to writers that I know they'll love.
Fiona McFarlane, thank you so much for speaking to us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Fiona McFarlane's The Sun Walks Down is published by Allen and Unwin. I'm Kate Evans, and we'll return to just one edition of The Bookshelf every week from next week. But if you're not sure what to read next, please do look back over our collection of stories. We have conversations with writers from all over the world. You can catch up on everything via the ABC Listen app. But I'll be back next time with Cassie McCullough and more books.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.